May it please the court. My name is Douglas Nolan. I represent the appellants in this case, the estate of Max Overby and Glenna Overby. This case presents this court with a case of first impression in which there is a challenge to the constitutionality of Section 510.265. This statute, as was applied to the claim of Max and Glenna Overby under the Missouri Merchandising Practice Act and their judgment of $1 million in punitive damages that was awarded by a Clay County jury and then formalized in a judgment by a Clay County circuit judge, was unconstitutionally under 510.265 reduced by $500,000. Now, we have raised in our brief seven areas in which we challenge the constitutionality of 510.265. We raised those issues at the earliest opportunity after the jury verdict was rendered, after the judgment was rendered by Judge Gabbard in this case, and then when the defendants filed a motion for new trial and remittiture, and at that very first time raised the statute 510.265 as a means to limit the amount of punitive damages. We raised the constitutionality of the statute at that time, and as I indicated, there were seven grounds that we set forth in our brief. First, I would like to begin by saying that...
Are you proceeding under statutory damages under 507, or if you get it, if you're granted, there's an argument, just like truth in lending, that the damages on a 407 case are really statutory, not necessarily punitive damages. If you're proceeding on, you get actual damages and damages according to 407. Are they punitive or are they statutory damages?
Well, what we had actual damages and punitive damages that were awarded in this case.
Okay.
The claim submitted by Max and Glenn Overby was under a 407, a Missouri Merchandising Practice claim. The jury made separate allocations of actual damages and then a separate allocation of punitive damages against the defendant in this case here. It is our contention, Your Honors, that 510.265 is unconstitutional, and I'd really like to try to address three main issues. One is being the separation of powers. Article 2, Section 1 of the Missouri Constitution provides that there shall be three distinct branches of government. What 510.265 did was usurp that power of the judiciary by creating this artificial cap, or as has been said by the court, a wholesale attempt at legislative remittiture to completely take away the jury's and the judiciary's function in the traditional role of a trial setting and substituted that role for the legislator's belief that punitive damages should be limited to five times the actual damages or $500,000, whichever is greatest. We submit that a statute is unconstitutional if it clearly contravenes some constitutional provision. And here, because the trial court was given no discretion to consider the weight of the evidence, the facts of the case, the need to punish or deter the defendant in this case, as well as the judge under a due process standard or a remittiture standard, was not given the opportunity to do that. But instead...
Now in 1820, there were probably, I wasn't around then, of course, but in 1820, there was provision, I'm sure, for lawsuits with misrepresentation or fraud, common law fraud. When the Merchandising Practice Act was passed, it cut back on the number of elements required to prove common law fraud, prove fraud. Or misrepresentation wasn't, the term fraud wasn't being used. But so 407 maybe is recodifying fraud as a misrepresentation, but it is still recodifying as a legislative act as far as merchandising practice. And then it provides for actual and punitive damages. Are you still able to get punitive damages as if it were a common law fraud case, even though it doesn't require the same number of elements? 407?
Yes, we believe that we are. We believe that 407 was created by the legislature in 1967 as a means to supplement common law fraud, to make it easier, to make it more accessible for consumers to bring types of claims. This court, since 1967, has had a long tradition of evolving the extent of the Missouri Merchandising Practice Act. And in 1972, when the legislature amended the act to bring a civil cause of action that could be brought by a private citizen. Originally, it was just brought by the Attorney General. But in the 70s, when the statute was amended to allow a private cause of action, and it is from that and the court's evolution of those cases that Max and Glenn Overby were able to bring
and
this
Bruce case. Springs case, actually, where the statute actually said damages as provided by the court. In the Blue Springs case, we decided you could have a jury trial on those kinds of cases.
Yes, I would agree that the Blue Springs, which was a per curiam opinion by this court in 2005, was a further extension that this court has given to the rights and the fundamental purpose of the Missouri Merchandising Practice Act, which is the protection of consumers.
In that case said, the last sentence of what I read before is, in short, a statute's not valid that provides for punitive damages, but precludes a jury trial to determine those damages. But here you did have a jury trial, and it kind of comes back to the question in the prior case. Are you precluding a jury from determining those damages if you let them determine it, but then there's a statutory limitation on how high those damages can be? And cases in other jurisdictions have gone all across the board on that. Some say you're just limiting the effect of the jury's determination. Others say you're interfering with the jury's determination. What's your take on that?
Well, the Scott opinion was a very good opinion by this court. And I know in the last case, Judge Stith, you pointed out that provision, how Scott distinguished from the Faust case that was decided about 10 years earlier, Judge Holstein's opinion. And I think what I gather from the Scott decision is that the legislature may be able to create or abolish a remedy, but they cannot impose a procedure which contravenes the Constitution. And that was the basis in Scott, where they said that the legislature had said punitive damages are only applicable under the Missouri Merchandising Practice Act, but they must be decided by the trial judge.
Was that basically the rationale of the court in Kilmer versus Munn?
Pardon?
Was that basically the same rationale as this court used in Kilmer versus Munn?
Yes.
And getting back to the separation of powers argument and looking at the Faust case, isn't that the same argument that we addressed in that case when the issue before us was 50% of the punitive damage award required to be paid to the tort victims compensation fund, and this court held that was not a constitutional violation?
Well, I think how this case is distinguishable from Faust, as Scott was distinguishable from Faust. But there was more or less two issues in Faust, and Faust said that after the full amount of the jury award is rendered, then the state could come in and take 50% of the award. And Faust, Judge Holstein, said that was not an unreasonable limitation of what the legislature could do. But in distinguishing Faust, as this court did in the Scott decision, we submit that you have to look at by the process by which the claim is determined. And we submit that the process by which this claim is determined is that the jury should have the right to determine punitive damages, and they should have the right to determine the full amount of punitive damages.
Well, in both cases, the jury does determine punitive damages, but the legislature reduces that amount either by, in this case, the 50, or in the Faust case, the 50% reduction, or in the case we have before us, an arbitrary number.
Well, we would submit that in Faust, the court said, and what the legislature did is said, once you have an award of punitive damages, this is how it can be allocated. Because the state has a legitimate interest in the amount of punitive damages, it is not unreasonable to say that 50% of that amount should go to the state, the Tort Victims Compensation Fund.
But the net effect is the plaintiff receives less money.
Correct. But in this case here, 510-265 implements a procedure. It implements a procedure that contravenes the Constitution because it takes away the ability of the jury to make the full amount of punitive damages and the full amount of their award. And
we as Judge Price mentioned earlier in the other case, I'm sorry to bring back the other case, but the punitive damages are often used as a way the jury, at the time immemorial, where the jury can say, well, something should be done about this, and we're looking at the net worth of the company that's the defendant. We want to send them, we want to issue punitive damages so they don't do it again, case by case, versus the legislature saying, this is, it sort of defeats the purpose of what punitive damages are about.
Well, we agree. That was a very good question by Judge Price and by you too, Judge. But
Judge Price's question.
We submit that there is a difference between non-economic damages and punitive damages. I mean, the whole principle behind non-economic damages, as was in the first case, is really to compensate the plaintiff and to make him whole. But in punitive damages, the purpose is to punish and deter the defendant and others from like or similar conduct. This court, Judge Teitelman, in your concurring opinion, and Scott, you said one of the most effective deterrents of fraudulent activity is the issuance of punitive damages. And that has been recognized by Gore versus BMW and State Farm versus Campbell at the United States Supreme Court level. So there is a difference between non-economic damages and punitive damages, because punitive damages focus on the conduct of the defendant, the conduct of the wrongdoer.
Can you address, though, in Cooper versus Leatherman in 2001, the U.S. Supreme Court said, unlike the measure of actual damages suffered, which presents a question of historical or predictive fact, the level of punitive damages is not really a fact tried by the jury, and therefore the courts can give de novo review, which they do, to the amount of punitive damages awarded by the jury, and the court specifically said that does not interfere with the right to jury trial, distinguishing between facts which are found in terms of amount of damages suffered, compensatory damages, versus punitive damages, precisely because of that distinction you're drawing, that they're not really to compensate for particular injuries which exist at a certain level, irrespective of what the jury finds. But they have a different social purpose. And you also have to balance due process with the right to have the jury find those damages. Does that affect your argument that it's inappropriate for the legislature to limit the amount of punitive damages because they're not it's not intruding on the right to have the jury trial in the same way as would perhaps a limitation on something on actual damages or other things?
Well, we would submit that 510-265 does limit. It limits the ability of the jury who has heard all of the evidence to make a determination as to what should be the appropriate amount of punitive damages in a case.
But when I say this case seems to say, I mean, rightly or wrongly, or maybe it's true under Missouri law, maybe not, but that the amount of punitive damages can be reviewed de novo by the appellate courts because it's not really a fact in the same sense that actual damages are. And I'm trying to figure out what the implications of that are for your argument.
Well, we agree that the fallacy of 510-265 is that it takes the jury and the judiciary out of the review of any punitive damage award. And kind of going along with the case that you've cited, what we contend should happen in this case is that on a finding of unconstitutionality, that this case be remanded back to the, whether it be this court, the Western District, or the trial court, for a determination by the judiciary as to whether or not that amount of punitive damage was appropriate under due process standards, so that there would be a judiciary review of the amount and award that the jury had rendered in this case here.
I want to make sure I understand the distinction between the arguments. I mean, one argument is this is a function that's constitutionally allocated to the jury. And if that argument is the argument that would prevail, it ought not to be remanded to the judiciary at all. It ought to be a jury power. On the other hand, if it's a separation of powers argument, then judiciary and judiciary could take a part in it, as opposed to legislature. Two separate ideas.
I understand your question. If I understand correctly, traditionally though, because these are punitive damages, the judiciary has always, in fairness to the defendants, has always had the ability, under due process standards, to review the jury amount.
So that's really an analysis of separation of powers.
Yes.
On that side, opposed to the right to a jury trial.
That would be correct, yes.
The right to a jury trial still assumes that both parties are entitled to due process as it relates to the unreasonableness of the verdict under the U.S. Supreme Court decisions.
Yes. And we submit that the
much akin to state remitter. In other words, it's always assumed that there is some review by a trial judge and then by a court, maybe a different standard of review, that the size of every verdict is subject to some review by the court, not necessarily the legislature.
Yes, and that is, again, the fallacy of 510-265, because it really deprived the defendant of making a due process argument, and it deprived the plaintiff of the opportunity to meet the argument and to win the argument that the ratio between actual damages and punitive damages did comport with due process.
Mm-hmm. Even though the statute took a rule of 10 and actually cut it in half.
Yes.
You're saying there might hypothetically be circumstances where a 5x jury verdict could be argued to be violative of due process.
Yes, and we submit, as this court has kind of said in a number of cases, in the Scott decision and even in Gore versus BMW, you really can't reduce these cases to precise mathematical formulas. It depends on the individual case. And that's where remittiture and the due process analysis can be there as a means to review what the jury had done in this case.
Are there any more questions?
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Patrick Liddon on behalf of the cross-appellant Chad Franklin, as well, who is also a respondent together with Chad Franklin National Auto Sales. While Mr. Nolan discussed the issues of the constitutionality of Section 510.265, we would submit that question is not properly before this court for its consideration today. The cross appeal that has been filed by Mr. Franklin would moot the constitutional issues that have been under discussion this morning. There are two issues that are dispositive of that issue. First and foremost, it is Franklin's position in his cross appeal that there should not have been a judgment entered against him in the first instance, that either a directed verdict or a J&OV should have been granted in his favor at the trial stage. Second, we have to look at the punitive damages award, even reduced by the judge under the statute, under the lens of the State Farm versus Campbell doctrine. And under that doctrine, the level of punitive damages is still high in excess of what is permitted under constitutional due process. And if, under State Farm, the damages must be lowered below the caps under 510.265, then this court need not even address the issue of the constitutionality of that statute in this particular case. There may be some case in the future where the question is squarely before the court, but it is not in this matter. First, let's look at the J&OV directed verdict issues. The evidence against Chad Franklin in the trial court proceedings was exceedingly slim. In looking back at the case last night, I kept coming back to the plaintiff's verdict director, which asked the jury to determine whether Franklin, Chad Franklin, had made a misrepresentation or a material omission with regard to the Overby transaction. And what we have of the evidence below is that there was no such misrepresentation or omission of fact by Franklin personally. He had a brief appearance in some television advertising saying that you'll be another satisfied customer. There was no evidence that Franklin had any role in determining the other content of the ad, in approving the ad, or in the underlying.
He was the owner of the companies, right?
He was the owner of the company, but that doesn't allow.
And I understand you're not piercing the veil, but why can't you infer that all those ads wouldn't have happened and all those people wouldn't have been subjected to the fraudulent program unless he knew? Why wasn't it up to the jury to believe or disbelieve that he was aware of what was going on? Why did they have to present direct evidence of that, as opposed to inferring it from the circumstance of his being owner during that time?
I think I understand your question. I don't think that's a reasonable inference, because there are many companies where the owner of the company has no real involvement in the day-to-day operations of the business. There are plenty of family companies where the actual titled owner may be an elderly member of the family, whereas the younger children are actually running the business. So I don't think it's a reasonable inference.
How big a company was this?
I didn't try the case, so I'm not real familiar with the actual size of the company. It was a motor vehicle dealership. Those tend to range anywhere from 20 to 50 or more employees. I don't know whether this was a large dealership or small dealership, since I wasn't at the trial stage. So with regard to the advertising, we've covered that. The only other evidence of Franklin's involvement was that there was supposedly a phone call made by a dealership employee where Franklin was represented to be on the other end of the telephone conversation. The only topic of discussion in that telephone conversation were the status of certain employees and whether Franklin, if he was at the other end of the phone, had any knowledge of the Overbee transaction. There was no evidence of any misrepresentations as to that call, and that call was also well after the Overbee transaction took place. So it's our position that, given the lack of evidence as to Franklin's personal conduct or his involvement in misrepresentation, he shouldn't have been even submitted to the jury. That the court should have granted a directed verdict, or after the verdict was submitted, given him a JNOV and entered judgment in his favor. If this court accepts that argument, we do not need to reach the constitutional issues, because if there is no judgment against Franklin, there can be no punitive damages award. Next, let's look at the State Farm issues. There are many factors to the State Farm analysis. I'm going to try to boil it down to, I think, the key factors that are applicable to this case. First and foremost, let's talk about the ratio of the actual damages award to the punitive damages award. Here, the actual damages awarded against Franklin were $4,500. The punitive damages, as it originally was awarded, was $1 million, reduced by the trial court to $500,000. That's still 111 times the amount of actual damages. And at least as the intermediate appellate courts have found in Kelly v. Bass Pro, this creates a presumption of unconstitutionality. Now, this, Mr. Nolan has argued in the briefing that this case falls into the special category for cases with limited actual damages, where the Supreme Court has said that maybe more than a single times multiplier is appropriate. While there is that exception, I don't think this case necessarily qualifies. First and foremost, even if it is a relatively small actual damages award, there has to be demonstration of conduct that is especially reprehensible. Again, here, our evidence as to Mr. Franklin is very thin. It's all about what the dealership did, what the dealership, other dealership's employees did. Nothing as to what Franklin individually did that necessitated a very substantial ratio here. So therefore, under that approach, I don't think this case fits neatly within that exception to the ratio requirement that State Farm discusses, that typically we should be looking at a single-digit ratio. I would also submit that even if we get beyond a single-digit ratio here, that just because of the small size of the actual damages award, I think it still needs to be anchored with the understanding that it should be in the range of a single-digit multiplier, maybe a low two-digit.
But often when you try, I think his name was Jim Bob Reed. Judge Price knows his name better than me. Who was a lawyer in Kansas City who has brought a lot of different cases for the consumers. You often, when you do the punitive, I think the case was Noble versus Commerce Bank, where it was found there was a wrongful repossession, and the tools that the person was using, I think, was worth about $6,000, were in the truck. Pickup truck was being repossessed, and he didn't have access to his tools for his business. And I think you didn't try the case, but often the way you deal with punitive damages is you have to have a submissible case, and partially you'd say, well, this is how much the company's worth. There's nothing, you know, you look at how much the equity is in the company, or in that case, Jim Bob Reed said, is it worth 1%? No one loses their job, but their net worth beyond their work, what they do day to day, is $100 million or $200 million, whatever it was. Is it worth 1%, 2%? And that's how you do it. What's the amount to follow up on the purpose of punitive damages? should we grant? So the actual damage was $6,000, but the role of punitive damages were to advise the company that they shouldn't be doing this again. If you give them $6,000 plus $6,000, it doesn't really, or even $30,000, it may not be enough. In the jury's estimation, it may not be enough to send the kind of message they want to.
Certainly, I think that has been historically an approach to punitive damages. I think that analysis may not quite be as strong since State Farm, because I think the U.S. Supreme Court has discussed that due process is the same regardless of whether you are a well-heeled defendant versus an impoverished defendant. You still have the same due process rights. So therefore, I'm not sure we can look to the size of the company or Mr. Franklin's individual assets, of which we don't have evidence in the record in this instance, to really use that as a basis to say, well, that justifies a large ratio here. Let me move on, since time is passing, to the issue of reprehensibility, since that's the other large State Farm factor that I think drives courts to question whether a ratio is constitutionally appropriate. Here, the questions of reprehensibility, the various sub-factors under this analysis, only one of them really, I think, is supporting the Overby's position here, and the other factors weigh heavily in favor of Mr. Franklin. There's the one particular issue is the issue of recidivism. Now, there was evidence presented at the trial court proceeding that there were other consumers who had similar complaints against the dealership. There was evidence both of, I believe, individual customers and some testimony from representatives of the AG's office. However, this evidence was, again, specifically directed at the dealership. I don't believe there was any evidence of complaints specifically against Franklin or his own, that he made any misrepresentations to other customers or made any material omissions to other customers. So again, if you look at the issue of recidivism, which the Overbys heavily lean on, I don't think it supports a finding that 111 times ratio is appropriate here. Next, let's look at the other reprehensibility factors. The type of harm that is involved in this case is purely economic. We're not dealing with an injury to a plaintiff. We're not dealing with a risk of a safety risk to consumers. We're not dealing with a risk to health. It's purely economic harm. So therefore, under this factor, again, we're looking at moving in a direction for a lower single-digit ratio. Another factor is economic vulnerability. Here, there was no evidence that the parties, the plaintiffs, were economically vulnerable. Now, there was evidence that their grandson and his wife were having to really cut corners because one of them was in school. But they're not the parties. We can't look at harm to non-parties under other areas of the U.S. Supreme Court's punitive damages case law. So just looking at the Overbys, no evidence that they were placed in any financial vulnerability or they suffered any real economic harm from having to just continue to make payments on this vehicle.
Your time is running low. Can you address the separation of powers argument raised by your opponent?
Certainly. I think in terms of separation of powers, we have to look at the lens of what the underlying claim is here. Here we're dealing with a claim under Chapter 407, the Missouri Merchandising Practices Act. This is a cause of action that is created by the legislature. It would be our position that what the legislature creates, it can limit and define.
Doesn't that run contrary to Deal with the Missouri Human Rights Act and said the legislature didn't have to pass that statute, but once it did, it's a damages action and you cannot deny a right to jury trial. They didn't have to create it, but when they did, they cannot limit the right to jury trial under it. Wouldn't this be comparable?
Well, I don't think it's quite on all fours because at least in that case you're dealing with a complete denial of a right to jury trial. Here we're really saying the jury gets the opportunity to look at the facts, at least to the extent that those feed into the punitive damages analysis, and offer to the court what it thinks the appropriate punitive damages are. However, that because it's a statutorily created cause of action, I think the legislature can say, well, we're going to create it, but we're going to limit how much you can recover, both in terms of actual damages and punitive damages. Here, of course, we're only talking about the punitive damages side of the equation. So I don't think it invades the issue or it crosses the line of separation of powers and invades the province of the judiciary to say that in a case where here we've got a statutory created cause of action to say, the plaintiff can only recover a certain amount of punitive damages. especially because, again, we're dealing in a post-State Farm versus Campbell world, where the U.S. Supreme Court has said that, while they did not provide us any bright lines necessarily, that punitive damages should be within a certain range. I think here, with this particular statute, the legislature was trying to respond to that and say, it is our sense as the legislature speaking for the public policy of Missouri that this is where Missouri should fall and address these State Farm factors. That, you know, in these cases, punitive damage should not exceed a single digit ratio of times by multiplier.
From a purely separation of power standpoint, if they can do it in statutorily created cause of actions, why couldn't they do it in common law causes of action?
Well, this is, again, not the case we have before us today, but I think there is room for the legislature, again, because of what we're seeing with the U.S. Supreme Court and State Farm, that these types of damages are not completely within the jury's discretion, that there are constitutional limits on how much punitive damages.
But the Supreme Court was not careful to allow for something other than the multiplier.
At least
whereas the statute doesn't, it just categorically says what it will be.
Certainly, at the present time, we have no firm limits from the U.S. Supreme Court. I think the legislature stepped in to say that in the larger cases where you're just looking at the times by multiplier, that is sufficient as a matter of law for these types of claims.
Now here, we're
dealing with a smaller case where our cap is $500,000.
Would your argument be the same if the legislature said put it at 20, regardless of actual damages? If it's truly a separation of powers claim, can't they add in, subtract?
Well, my argument might be different, because I'd probably be arguing that would be unconstitutional to say that you can get up to 20 times multiplier. But
well, what's the difference from purely a separation of powers standpoint? I mean, they can give, can they take? They can take, can they give? What's the difference?
Yeah, since we're dealing here with we're not dealing with a case where we're dealing with a common law remedy, it's difficult for me to articulate a position based on the facts we've got here.
Well, I understand the distinction, the common law remedy, as it relates to your right to jury trial. But I'm trying to have somebody explain to me the difference in a way I can understand as it relates to separation of powers. Mm-hmm.
You know, my best probably entry into this issue is the purpose of punitive damages is to punish and deter. They're quasi-criminal in nature. I think an analogy could be drawn to the role of the legislature in deciding criminal penalties, as I think Judge Price was alluding to a little bit in the prior case, that while, you know, the legislature can decide how to punish someone, what penalties to assign. And therefore, I think we're here in that kind of intermediate area between a civil cause of action and criminal penalties, that's an area that the legislature can properly speak to in an exercise of its role in our system of government.
And how low can they go? How low can the legislature set the floor for the amount of punitive damages and still be constitutional?
That's a difficult question to ask or to answer, but I would say so long as we are within the range of what is permitted under State Farm, allowing a plaintiff an opportunity to obtain deterrence, but not so high that it would violate the defendant party's right to due process.
But State Farm sets a ceiling, and I'm asking about a floor.
I'm not sure if that. I would not take a position that the legislature could completely eliminate punitive damages. I think there is some room to say that a plaintiff has a right to seek deterrence from a party who is wrong, though. They can't limit just punitive damages, but if there's punitive damages that are proper, they must be cabined within due process, and I think the statute does that.
Can the legislature pick and choose the types, the ratios based upon the type of defendant? In other words, could it be times three for doctors, times two for shooting ranges, times five for ordinary citizens, times 10 for corporations?
Well, I think that's getting us pretty far afield from our facts, but I think
lawyers.
That would create us some real equal protection.
My concern
issue.
Is that the facts of this case, based on the separation of powers doctrine, might apply to every case. That's why I asked the question.
I think that would encounter some equal protection issues in terms of why are we treating one group of citizens so radically different from another.
Well, that's part of the statute, too, that you're your opposing counsel says, well, there are some exceptions, too.
Correct. But you actually have to look, when you look at those under the equal protection analysis, those exceptions pass constitutional muster because they're rationally related to legitimate
state purposes. Except it's the jury. It's dealing with the jury. It should be inviolate. It doesn't necessarily fit into the same analysis as rational justification.
Well, obviously, we take a different position on whether or not a fundamental right is involved. We would argue that rational basis review applies to that analysis, and we're not dealing with a fundamental right where strict scrutiny must be applied to equal protection.
Let me ask you one more question. I'm not asking this in regards to equal protection, and I'm not asking it in regards to your right to a jury trial, but specifically the doctrine of separation of powers. What's the difference between statutorily created causes of action and common law causes of action as it relates to the doctrine of separation of powers? And why does it matter?
The reason it matters is because when we're dealing with common law causes of action, we're dealing with causes of action that were recognized and created by the courts through their own inherent authority. When you're dealing with a statutorily created cause of action, it's something that the legislature has created. It has the ability to determine what that cause of action is and what its remedies are. And that the court's then role is to apply that statutory scheme. The courts can't diverge from that once the legislature has spoken.
So they can create them or they can take them away and it doesn't matter? That's my question.
Well, if there was a statutory cause of action that the legislature then said we're no longer willing to recognize in Missouri, I think that may be open to question on that particular case whether if it completely eliminates a remedy for a certain group of citizens of Missouri, that may be an issue under other aspects of the Missouri Constitution. But that's simply not the situation we have here. A remedy exists, a right exists to bring claims for this cause of action. The question is simply how much punitive damages is appropriate under State Farm and whether or not in this instance, of this case, whether there should have been a judgment in the first instance against Mr. Franklin.
Are there any more questions? Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
On the statute of separation of powers argument, we submit that the fallacy and the error of 510-265 under separation of powers doctrine is that the legislature took away a power that belonged to the judiciary, and it interfered with that power that belonged to the judiciary to review a decision based on due process standards, based on common law principles or now statutory principles of remittiture under 587 and Rule 7810. The legislature took that away from the judiciary, and we believe that is a violation of the separation of powers.
Let me ask you in this context. Our Constitution utilizes a system of checks and balances to power so that no one has absolute power over any decision. If we say that this is a power, our power to review judgments is a power the legislature can never interfere with by setting caps or boundaries, does that eliminate any check on our power in that area, or what other check would be available?
No, I don't think it eliminates. I think the judiciary, back to Marbury versus Madison, always had the initial and final check on the legitimacy of a law. Just as in this case here, the judiciary should have the final review as to whether this punitive damage award is appropriate under remittiture standards or a due process standards.
I guess what I'm saying is if we would approve some extraordinarily high amounts of punitive damages in cases, would there be no way to check our awards of those high punitive damages amounts?
Well,
so the legislature could never come back in and say, no, you really can't give over $100 million, or you can't give relative to a $10 case.
Well, I think the judiciary always ought to have the ability to review the case based on the facts, based on the weight of the evidence, based on the need to deter the defendant from like or similar conduct in making an award of punitive damages, reviewing it based upon those principles that were set forth in Gore and later in State Farm versus Campbell.
Yeah, and whether would there be a role in the legislature at all as to amounts, appropriate amounts of damages?
No.
Did the legislature have to allow punitive damages? It would have been okay if they had simply created a compensatory damage remedy under the Act?
That's a good question. I would think that under the Faust opinion, that the legislature could eliminate punitive damages and say you're not entitled to them, or you are entitled to them. But the fallacy becomes when they say this is the procedure that is implemented, and if that procedure contravenes the Constitution, the procedure in which you acquire your punitive damages, just like in Scott. In Scott was a statutory determination. Well, I guess you could say it begins with Deal, because Deal says there's no right to a trial by jury in a human rights case. Then Scott says, we'll look at the Missouri Merchandising Practice Act, and we'll say that even though the law said you don't get a right to trial by jury on punitive damages, this court said in Scott, no, the Missouri Merchandising Practice Act, because that involves such a fundamental right, you do get a right to trial by jury as to the determination of punitive damages. And we submit that that should go one step further in this case here, that the right to trial by jury that heretofore shall remain inviolate should extend to allow the jury to determine the full amount based upon its review of the evidence and its review of the entirety of the case, and set an amount that will properly deter and punish the defendant for their conduct. On equal protection, we submit that is a valid claim under this case here, because the principle under Article 1, Section 2 of the Missouri Constitution is that people cannot similarly situated cannot be treated different. And this statute specifically excludes three classes of people, and there is no compelling state interest or rational basis that either the state of Missouri or someone who has had a prosecutor prosecute a defendant in a case and obtained a conviction, or housing discrimination victims, should be treated any different than Max and Glenna Overby in this case here.
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.